Boyoki binomoro nansi semaine prochaine penza boza la mingi en écoute toko développer penda histoire na molai penza pour le toya ki sou na tenté to tikana penza na tam oké Julien comment ki na bar état a kangama ki na métro ndenge bolandie mais ezali penda sujet moko très très important ndenge boyoki toko développer ngo penza na molai penza pour na bino bana mboka bana Congo donc to komi penda na souka pour na lelo mais mardi prochain 19h, boza à l'écoute pour toko panza penza, toko décortique penda histoire ou toko kende nango penza, namolai penza. This is all we had time for you today. We are at the end of our show. So you've been listening to Laundry Labiso on Resonance 104.4 FM. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. Coming up in half an hour, we've got The Clear Spot, where Alex Gorkowski will be looking at the early history of recorded sound, and that's our clear spot for this evening. But right now, it's time for Wavelength.
Modulation fréquence 104,4 MHz à Londres. Voi sentite un trasmissione radio della programma Lunghezza d'onda con Guglielmo Inglese sulla stazione Risonanza. Modulazione frequenza su 104,4 MHz a Londra. Sie hören der Radioprogramm Wellenlänge mit Wilhelm Englisch vom Sender Resonanz. Frequenzmodulation 104,4 MHz in London. You are listening to the radio broadcast Wavelengths with William English on the station Resonance 104.4 FM in London.
Hello, I'm William English, and you are listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the interweb. For the last 2 weeks, I've been talking to Ed Baxter, Programming Director for Resonance 104, and this week I'll be talking to Ed Baxter, Programming Director for Resonance 104. Welcome back, Ed.
Hello, William. It's 104.4.
I'm terribly sorry. You're absolutely right. Yes, indeed. Sorry. Shall I go back to the beginning?
No, that's all right. I just for Ofcom reasons, I should point that out, I think.
Right. In future, I'll stick to the script. Sorry. Is it Edmund or Edward?
Edmund.
Edmund.
Yes.
But you've always dropped the Mund.
No, on the front cover of De Quincey's Art of Autobiography, Edmund.
Right. Yes. You wrote this?
Elsewhere. Yes, it was the book that Edinburgh University Press published based on my PhD thesis. It came out in 1985 or 86 or something, remained about 18 months later.
But it was published.
Oh, a proper book.
Right, yeah. A real book. And it's out there under Edmund Baxter.
It was out there, and it sunk without a trace, I think I could say that.
Okay.
Pretty definitely. I fondly imagined, as one does, that it would somehow change the course of romanticist studies. But not only was it juvenilia, essentially, but it fatally came out in the same month as John Barrow's infinitely more sophisticated, clever, informed and mature book, De Quincey's Infection, or something. It's called some slightly strange title, I forget the name of which. And that got all the reviews, and my sorry little book didn't get any reviews apart from in one or two academic journals. And then came the day, all too soon, when EUP wrote to me saying, "We are remaindering your book. If you want to buy any copies, you have 2 weeks to send us a check." Mm-hmm. So I bought all the remaining copies and made a reasonable amount of money out of it that way, actually.
Yeah.
When I say reasonable, I made a couple of £100 out of a couple of hundred copies.
Yeah.
I might have one or two lying around.
Okay.
Ben Watson read it this year and was very positive about it, actually.
Right.
I reluctantly handed it to him.
Well, we'll have to get some signed copies. Auction them off.
Yeah, that can be arranged.
Okay. Well, at the end of last week's show, I asked you about the funding position of Resonance, which prompted a slightly sort of weary response, followed quickly by an announcement that you are on the brink of a deal which might solve the problem for 2 or 3 years.
Did I say that?
I think you did. But I haven't yet been able to hear the repeats of any of these programs we've done, so I can't. I haven't been able to verify.
That's because I've suppressed them. I think I was referring to an art auction that I'm planning for the autumn. How quickly one changes one's mind in a week. Now I'm sort of despairing of it, but I've got another week to sort it out, to actually get the artist to commit to giving us artwork. So I shall be on the phone, and probably I should make an on-air plea to any bankable artists to drop me a line as quickly as possible.
Right.
But I've had this sort of up my sleeve as an idea for many years, and thought we should only really have recourse to it when absolutely necessary, and now it's necessary to try and get some favours from the people who must spend most of their waking lives being asked for favours, the great and the good.
And is it because is this a particularly bad time, or is it just kind of an ongoing?
It's really that other options have petered out. We've been relying for a couple of years on a couple of trusts and foundations who are at the end of our funding relationship with. Not for any negative reason, just that that's how these things are. You can't expect to rely upon anybody forever.
No.
Sadly.
No. So would this be an online auction? Is this sort of
No, it would be in a proper auction house.
Oh, in an auction house. Oh, yes. That would be nice. Yes. Great, yeah.
I can't give you the details because none of it's signed and sealed. But it's,
so you need the cooperation of an auction house to do this?
I have the cooperation of an auction house.
Uh-huh.
And of three artists so far, but I need the other 17 to say yes for it to reach some kind of critical mass. But it's not impossible. It's just... I got beyond being embarrassed asking people. It's just that they're not responding.
Right. You've already sent out...
sent out my begging letter.
Right, okay. So this is an opportunity in a way. Should people do anything about this who are out there, listeners? Is there anything that, or not?
Yes, if you work for White Cube or House Rand Worth or anybody else, think deeply about supporting your community radio station.
Yeah. I actually had to deliver something to the Gagosian Gallery this morning.
Right.
Just delivering a book to the desk, of course, but it's like a sort of palace of art in there. Do you know the one on Britannia Street?
Yeah.
seriously sort of wealthy place, but it's quite a good exhibition on the moment. Tom Friedman is on it. It's quite an interesting show. Have you seen the Chapman brothers at the White Cube?
I haven't. I've heard about it from Subab Gupta, and he recommended it.
It is very good.
And of course, Brian Sewell gave it a rave review in the Evening Standard.
Did he? Yeah. Oh, that's okay. We'll move on. Did he really?
Brian Sewell loves the Chapman brothers. He hates the peer group. He thinks they're extremely gifted artists. His approach is essentially from a technical point of view, but also he has his own psychological idiosyncrasies that they evidently tickle.
Right.
He's usually fairly astute as a critic, if you like, that sort of acerbic attitude towards...
He's certainly acerbic, yeah.
Those things.
All right. Last week we also touched on the politics of the London Musicians Collective and your meteoric rise to the present position. It's my word.
Meteoric.
Have the ethics of collectivity been discarded now that the LMC has been dissolved?
I don't think so, because I think this project itself is very much a group effort. I'm sort of interested in working with other people in groups, certainly, and always tried to do that, at least to some extent. I think probably because doing things like academic research, I worked on my PhD for about 4 years and the complete works of De Quincey for about 10. That kind of work is extremely lonely and isolating and self-contained, so that you can go weeks on end without speaking to another human being. Mm. So from my personal point of view, I would like to balance those sort of activities with ones that involve small numbers of people. I'm not a great fan of going to Wembley Stadium or the London Marathon or a thing, but I like the dynamic that a small group will
bring. You're still involved in academic research? You're doing something?
No, not actually. No. The De Quincey edition was delivered about 6 months after the radio license went in. After I'd handed my part of the project in to Pickering and Chatto, the publishers, I'd actually planned to take 6 months or a year off everything to try and clear my brain out and decide what it is I should do next. But instead I signed the letter of intent to Ofcom to get Resonance back on course, and did that thinking that I'd take it seriously in the unlikely event that they took it seriously.
Right.
Which they did about a month later. So I still haven't had that break that I was planning. And I haven't had any, either the chance or, to be honest, the inclination to do any academic research. I haven't even taken the De Quincey edition out of the box it arrived in. I haven't broken the tape and taken it out to look at.
Right.
It's sort of makes me feel ill to think of it, to be honest. But maybe soon I might do that.
Right.
But I kind of burnt out on that front from dealing with the material far in too much depth. And that wasn't just me. Several of the other editors were sort of crushed by the project.
By the
De Quincey project, the shared project.
It's a shared project.
I was just one of the co-editors.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
right.
I wasn't the editor-in-chief. I was just one of their hired hands.
Right.
But it's a kind of strange thing to do, and not something I can recommend to anybody, to be honest.
So do the LMC members or ex-members now, I mean, it has been dissolved as such, hasn't it?
No, not yet.
No? No. Oh, right. So it still exists, has it?
Okay. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Right. I thought it's... Anyway. So do they have any influence on the radio station as such? Is it sort of...
Well, they will, in so far as we're going to have an AGM very soon. And in fact, I'm very keen to encourage the extant members to make a positive decision about the role of the LMC and of Resonance, because I think they legitimise the project in a way that the other users of the resource do, you know, the programme makers and the volunteers and the engineers and so on and so forth. I mean, there's quite a lot of what would be called stakeholders.
Yeah.
But I think the grassroots bed provided by the LMC membership is an important one to acknowledge. I don't think that the radio station is just a free-floating entity that came out of nowhere.
Mm.
I think it came from certain shared impulses and certain antagonisms even. So, I mean, without being terribly sentimental about the LMC, I think that's important not to just close the coffin lid and bang in the nails. I personally think it's still got a lot of potential and life in it, but I also recognise that at the moment the people who one might like to think were encouraged are mostly depressed and demoralised, which I think is part of the kind of trend in the arts community at the moment anyway. I find most people working in contemporary music are extremely demoralised.
Hmm. Is this as a result of lack of funding or opportunities or just...
Well, it's deeper than that. I think it's been the case for about 25 years, really. I think people have been apologising for what they do for so long that it's become second nature. And so when guns are held to heads and money is dangled in front of noses and so on and so forth, they do exactly what one would expect rather than what they should do. But that's, you know, that strays immediately into personal morality and all those sort of embarrassing issues that are not discussed, because it would, you know, we vote New Labour instead, if you like. You know, the transactions are predetermined from afar. And the alibis are written for you, so that currently everyone is blaming the Olympics or Gordon Brown or whatever, whereas in fact the reality is their own individual lack of responsibility and lack of imagination, actually. It sounds terribly harsh, but that's that frankly is how I think about the situation. Not that I blame people, it's just that is the case.
But have circumstances brought about this attitude?
I don't really know what's brought it about.
Is it lack of encouragement, perhaps, that there isn't enough impetus to encourage people to pursue the...
Yes, I think new music is not taken very seriously. And it's not commercially successful, and it's too awkward to attract critics like Brian Sewell, for example. Yeah, just as in terms of column inches that contemporary art does fill newspapers and contemporary music doesn't, essentially.
Right.
But it's very complicated. I mean, it's sort of all wrapped up in the nostalgia industry that compact discs ushered in, and the sort of dead hand of people who should have retired a long time ago. It's, you know, nobody really expected the Rolling Stones to last longer than
no.
than Queen Victoria.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And in fact, the aesthetic, you know, the rock aesthetic, for example, part of it should be that you split up after 3 years or sooner.
Yeah, yes, that's a yes, that is a tricky one. I suppose if you're a blues, a true blues player,
well, you should fade into obscurity,
yeah. Right?
And yeah. Be exploited by young white males.
Yeah. Okay. So you've been attending live events consistently for many years, giving you an encyclopedic knowledge of the improvising scene and live music generally. And you write for The Wire magazine, of course.
Well, I have written for The Wire, but not recently, actually.
I always notice your name at the beginning. There's a whole list of people who contribute, and there's a great list of people. And I think, well, which bit has Ed written?
Yeah, you know, it's very sort of kind fun. Of them to keep my name there.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I wrote for The Wire. Probably in the first few months of the radio station coming into being. So probably not for 6 years now.
Uh-huh.
Partly that was my choice, because I felt that I was writing the same review over and over with a different artist's name at the top, and I recognised that in other writers, and I thought, well, if I'm bored of it, then the reader is very likely to be bored of it, and the editor even more bored. And I think the last thing I wrote was about... they had a feature on Popular Song, and I wrote a few entries for that, you know, a few recommendations. But I think someone like Howard Jakes pointed out that I'd written the same stuff in 1987, and I recognised that my tiny little argument hadn't gained any ground in 20 years, however long it was, and never would, really. And then I noticed earlier this week I was tidying my flat and I came across a piece I'd written about the Incredible String Band that in my imagination was a kind of beautiful piece of writing. And I'd sort of been looking for this thing because I thought, well, I'd really got it together then. Mm. But then when I read it, it was almost embarrassing. I couldn't get through it. It was sort of, you know, it's disgusting and horrible. And I hid it away from myself, having found it, because I just thought it was such guff and
inelegant. Very hard on yourself again, aren't you? Well, you're very self-critical.
It was very inelegant. It was kind of purple and ponderous, and it showed all the signs of having spent 10 years editing De Quincey, actually.
All right. But doesn't The Wire surely... reflects the contemporary music scene or not? You're talking about column inches and the amount of, you know,
yes, it does, but so on. It doesn't have the gravitas or social clout or media presence as Jeremy Paxman or John Humphreys or any of these kind of people with a national presence. I mean, you compare, you know, though you'll get very earnest and informed commentary in The Wire by enthusiasts, and then you'll turn on the Today program and John Humphreys will be snorting with derision at Jem Finer's Hole in the Ground or something.
Oh, right.
Sort of irresistible. And that seems to be far more the, you know, what people are thinking outside the closed circle of enthusiasts and supporters. Yeah. And of course, the outside that circle, people obsess. Apparently, I've never met anybody, but apparently, we're all obsessed with Amy Winehouse Pete Doherty and that kind of power elite. But I try not to go to North London. As you know.
Yes. Mm. Okay. On a more personal note, you once attended a Max Miller appreciation event, I think.
I took my daughter, Trilby, to the unveiling of the statue of Max Miller in Brighton. And Ken Dodd was meant to be unveiling it, so I stuck around because I wanted Trilby to see Ken Dodd, who's now getting on a bit.
Yes.
And I thought, well, this would be a great thing, but Ken Dodd apparently typically was very late, but we did see Dennis Norden and Michael Aspel and Dora Bryan turned up, very exquisitely dressed, but also she must be in her 90s by now.
Really?
Yeah. She was more or less invisible behind a crowd of admirers.
And does everybody dress up like Max Miller?
There are a lot of middle-aged men, not me, I must say, who dress up like Max Miller.
That was my next question.
Yeah. Well, given the opportunity, I'm not sure that I wouldn't, but I have none of Max Miller's wit or speed of thought or humour. So I'd be very uninteresting Max Miller if I went on stage dressed as Max Miller and talked about funding cut. Slip into Max Miller.
Absolutely.
Already.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say,
easier than I think.
I wondered if you had a sort of a secret desire to be a sort of loud extrovert telling blue jokes, perhaps.
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
I'm very poor at remembering jokes. I mean, I'm still telling jokes from about 1972, I think,
and
have no memory for them. And no desire to enter that world.
Right. Yet. Okay. But the performance was a bit quite self-exposing, I suppose you might call it. It's quite the performance you did at.
It got a few laughs.
Beaconsfield. Yeah.
Chris Weaver was laughing his head off.
I'll bet he was. Yes. Yeah. I mean that's. Yeah.
That's quite easy to get that kind of laugh if you're obese, pale, and it's freezing cold.
Come. Obese, get out of here. Okay, and Phil Oakes. You have an interest in Phil Oakes.
Well, funnily enough, a colleague upstairs is dubbing off an interview I did with Bob Rafkin 4 years ago. I was planning a program about Phil Oakes. Bob Rafkin was a guitarist in Phil Oakes' band. In fact, it's probably made about 7 trips back to London since I did the interview. I've had an abiding interest in him since I was about 16, and it hasn't really waned. I don't know, that tells you probably a lot about me rather than him. I still find his take on things inspiring, and it's sort of stuck in my head in the same way, but probably a better way, that the lyrics of Sergeant Pepper or Abbey Road or something like that stuck in my head. But I like his attitude and his songs. But that again, it would take a long time to explain why, because he changed a lot through his career, and there's a lot of contradictions in his life to do with fame and politics and his own personal problems. I still think he's kind of interesting and forgotten character to a large extent. And I suppose actually one of my retreats from the world of The Wire was because Chris Bond didn't want to run a piece about Phil Oakes on the 25th anniversary of his death. And I thought, oh, all right then. Yeah, to hell with it.
Really?
Yeah. I don't run a magazine, so I can't.
Right. But he was a political singer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Political singer.
And I think he died quite young, didn't he? I don't know much about
him. He killed himself in his early 30s, yes. Why does anybody do that? But that's not the most interesting thing about him. It's his eloquence, I think, is what appeals to me, and his wit, and his slightly braying American voice I find curiously attractive, although I could see a dozen reasons for finding it unattractive.
But that's okay.
The same could be said of Buddy Holly, couldn't it? Or of Lead Belly, or of many other people.
Yes. I think on that note, we are once again approaching 3:30.
We should have just done a kind of 8-hour special, really, shouldn't we?
Yes.
You know, I'm gradually taking over the show.
You want my show?
Next week, you'll come in.
Ed Baxter presents Wavelength.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks.
Will you keep the ticking clock? Or?
Yes, yeah. We've got 5 seconds of it.
5 seconds. Well, thank you very much to Ed Baxter for coming in once again. I have no idea what's coming up next.
It's Cecilia Wee, Art and War.
And who's going to press the button?
You bring down the vocals and I'll bring up the...
Okay, here we go.
...machine.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. It's now time for our clear spot this evening. We're going to be looking at the early history of recorded sound with Alex Korkospy's Horatio Oratorio.
I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World to delight those who would have melody or be amused. I can sing you tender songs of love. I can give you merry tales and joyous laughter. I can transport you to the realms of music. I can cause you to join in the rhythmic dance. I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World to delight those who would have melody or be amused. I can sing you tender songs of love. I can give you merry tales and joyous laughter. I can transport you to the realms of music. I can cause you to join in the rhythmic dance. I can lull the babe to sweet repose or waken in the aged heart soft memories of youthful days. No matter what may be your mood, I am always ready to entertain you. When your day's work is done, I can bring the theater or the opera to your home. I can give you grand opera, comic opera, or vaudeville. I can give you sacred or popular music, band, orchestra, or instrumental music. I can render solos, duets, trios, quartets. I can aid in entertaining your guests. When your wife is worried after the cares of the day and the children are boisterous, I can rest the one and quiet the other. I never get tired, and you will never tire of me, for I always have something new to offer. I give pleasure to all, young and old. I will go wherever you want me, in the parlor, in the sick room, on the porch, in the camp, or to your summer home. If you sing or talk to me, I will retain your songs or words and repeat them to you at your pleasure. I can enable you to always hear the voices of your loved ones, even though they are far away. I talk in every language. I can help you to learn other languages. I am made with the highest degree of mechanical skill. My voice is the clearest, smoothest, and most natural of any talking machine. The name of my famous master is on my body and tells you that I am a genuine Edison phonograph. The more you become acquainted with me, the better you will like me. Ask the dealer.